Welcome to the deep dive. Ever wondered what truly goes into creating a commercial kitchen? It's way, way more than just stoves and refrigerators, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Much more.
Today, we're plunging into the crucial considerations of designing and equipping these spaces. We're talking safety, efficiency, and even, like, how your food ends up tasting and the whole vibe of the place.
That's right. And we've sifted through a ton of material here, everything from the, you know, the foundational rules of the game right up to the latest cutting edge tech. Okay. Our goal is really to give you the essential knowledge, kind of a shortcut to understanding what makes these really vital spaces tick.
Yeah, distilling it down. So we'll be navigating the bedrock of sanitation with NSF standards, looking at how smart energy choices are transforming kitchens.
Big one.
Exploring the trends, shaping where and how we eat, uncovering some seriously cool innovations, and looking at the indispensable role of the expert who kind of orchestrates it all.
Yeah, pulling it all together.
Yeah. So whether you're maybe knee deep in planning a new kitchen, thinking about an upgrade, or just, you know, fascinated by the unseen world behind the restaurant door, you're in for some surprising insights, I think.
Oh, definitely.
Okay, let's dive in. The absolute foundation, NSF standards.
Right. The National Sanitation Foundation, NSF, they've been the authority on food equipment safety for, wow, over 70 years now.
70 years, okay.
Yeah. And basically, their standards ensure that the tools used to prepare and serve our food are not just tough, but also safe and really crucially easy to keep clean.
And these aren't just like helpful tips, are they? They're the real deal.
Oh.
What are the core things NSF focuses on?
Well, they have three main pillars, you could say. First is material safety.
Okay.
So making sure that nothing harmful from the equipment itself can actually get into the food.
Well,
no chemical leaching, that kind of thing.
Right.
Second is design and construction. This is all about making sure equipment has smooth, non-porous surfaces, no little cracks or crevices where bacteria love to hide. And the third is product performance. Basically, they put the equipment through its paces, rigorous testing, to make sure it can actually handle the demands of a busy commercial kitchen day in, day out.
Smooth and non-porous. Sounds simple, but I bet the devil's in the details, like those corners I always seem to hear about.
Exactly. You'd hit it. Think about corners inside equipment or walk-ins. NSF mandates coved corners.
Coved, meaning rounded.
Rounded, yeah, instead of sharp 90-degree angles. It might seem like a tiny detail, but it's honestly a game-changer for sanitation.
How so?
Well, that smooth curve makes cleaning so much more effective. It prevents food bits, grease, you name it, bacteria from getting trapped. Square corners, they're just notorious for collecting gunk.
Ah, okay. I can picture that.
So the key takeaway here is preventing bacteria really starts on the drawing board, you know, not just with the cleaning crew later.
Right, right. It's about designing it to be cleanable from the get-go.
Mm.
So how do we actually know if a piece of equipment meets these standards? Is it like a sticker or something? Mm,
pretty much, yeah. That's where the NSF certification mark comes in. But yeah. Getting that mark, it's a whole process.
Okay.
First, they do product design audits. They literally review the blueprints, the specs, to make sure the design itself meets the standards. Then they conduct manufacturing audits. They go to the factory, make sure the equipment is consistently being built according to those approved designs.
Right.
And it doesn't stop there. There's also ongoing monitoring. They do follow-up checks, testing, to ensure that manufacturers keep complying over time.
So it's not a one-and-done thing they keep checking. That's reassuring.
Definitely.
You mentioned some specific design standards beyond just corners. What about, like, lighting? Does NSF care about light bulbs?
Huh. Surprisingly, yes. Even lighting has rules. They require a minimum of 40 lumens per watt.
Okay, why?
Well, partly it's about making sure staff can actually see what they're doing, which is a safety thing. But it's also tied into energy efficiency, which we'll get into more later.
Okay, everything's connected.
It is. And speaking of efficiency and temperature, insulation in walk-in coolers and freezers is absolutely critical. NSF sets specific R values.
R values. Like for home insulation.
Exactly the same principle. Think of it like the thickness or quality of a winter coat for your cooler. Higher number, better insulation. NSF requires R25 for coolers, R32 for freezers, and even R28 for floors in freezers.
Wow, specific.
Very. These levels are crucial for maintaining consistent temperatures without the refrigeration system working overtime, which, again, saves energy.
Okay, walk-in construction itself. Sounds like there's more to it than just putting up some walls. What are some NSF things to think about there?
Yeah, for walk-ins, the type of panel used is really important for NSF. Generally, foamed-in-place panels are considered the best choice.
Foamed-in-place.
Yeah, the insulation is injected between metal skins, creating a really solid, seamless panel. It provides a tight seal, minimizes air leaks, and crucially, the surfaces are smooth and easy to clean. Helps prevent bacteria growth.
Okay, and the alternative?
The older style sometimes uses wood frame panels. These are just more prone to absorbing moisture over time, and moisture inside a wall panel. Well, that can lead to mold, bacteria issues. Not good in a food environment.
Definitely not. Okay, what about the floors inside these walk-ins? Anything special there?
Absolutely. Especially for coolers. Recessed floors that slope slightly towards a drain are really helpful. They prevent water from pooling up after cleaning or spills.
Makes sense.
You might also see high-screed floors. These are raised slightly, allowing air to circulate underneath, which also helps manage moisture. And a really key point, freezer walk-ins always need insulated floors. Can't skip that.
Right, because the cold would just go straight into the ground otherwise.
Exactly. Huge energy waste and potential condensation problems. Oh, and if you're putting a walk-in on, say, a second floor, you've got major structural things to consider, too. The weight.
Right, yeah, tons of weight. Okay, yeah. Shifting from the box itself to what goes inside the food, temperature control, obviously vital. What does NSF say or align with there?
NSF guidelines definitely reinforce the vital food safety regulations around temperatures. For cooking, the common rule is hitting an internal temp of 165 degrees Fahrenheit and holding it for at least 15 seconds. That's the benchmark for killing most harmful bacteria.
165 for 15 seconds. Got it. What about keeping food hot?
For hot holding, the standard is keeping food at 140 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. Prevents bacteria from growing again. There is a notable exception for certain large roasts, which can sometimes be held at 130, but only under very specific controlled conditions monitored closely.
Okay, 140 generally. Now, the tricky part, cooling food down. That always seems like a danger zone.
It absolutely is. Cooling is a critical control point, and NSF guidelines stress the need for rapid cooling. You have to get food from that 140 degrees down to 70 degrees within 2 hours.
2 hours, okay.
And then from 70 down to 41 degrees within an additional 4 hours. So 6 hours total max, but with that intermediate step.
Wow, that's pretty strict timing. How do kitchens actually manage that?
It's tough without the right tools. Commercial kitchens often rely on specialized equipment like blast chillers. These are basically super-powered refrigerators designed just for cooling things down fast.
Blast chillers. Sounds intense.
They are very effective. Or sometimes simpler tools like ice paddles, basically containers you fill with water and freeze, then stir into hot liquids like soups or sauces to cool them quickly from the inside out.
Ice paddles, huh? Clever. Okay, let's talk about another workhorse, the dishwasher. Huge sanitation role there.
Yeah.
NSF must have standards, right? I know there are different types.
Oh, definitely. NSF covers both main types.
Right.
High temperature and low temperature dishwashing systems.
Okay, high temp first. What's the deal there?
High temp machines sanitize using incredibly hot water for the final rinse. We're talking 180 degrees Fahrenheit.
Whoa, that's hot.
It is. And interestingly, because the water is so hot, they don't actually rely on chemical sanitizers. The heat itself does the sanitizing.
Advantages.
Big ones are faster drying times. The dishes come out so hot, they flash dry, and it's very effective at cutting through grease, baked on food, even things like lipstick, without needing extra chemicals.
Okay, downsides.
Usually a higher initial purchase cost. And crucially, they almost always require a condensate hood, usually what's called a type 2 hood, to capture and vent all the steam they produce.
Ah, the steam. So that adds complexity. What's the difference between a type 2 hood and others? Quickly.
Basically, type 2 hoods are designed primarily for heat and moisture removal, not grease-laden vapors like you'd need over a fryer or griddle, which would be a type I hood.
Got it. Okay, so that's high temp. What about low temp systems? How do they sanitize?
Low temperature systems, as the name implies, use cooler water. They rely on chemical sanitizers, typically chlorine-based, injected into the final rinse water to kill bacteria.
Pros and cons there.
Generally, a lower upfront cost for the machine itself. But the trade-offs, well, drying times are significantly longer because the dishes don't get as hot.
So you need more space for drying racks.
Exactly. You need space for dishes to air dry. And there's the ongoing cost and hassle of managing the chemicals, buying them, storing them safely, making sure the dispenser is working correctly.
And any risks with chemicals?
There's a potential risk, yeah, of chemical residue remaining on the dishes if the machine isn't rinsing properly or the chemical levels are off. Plus, while some ventless low-temp designs exist, many still require ventilation depending on the chemicals used and local codes.
Okay. So definite trade-offs between the two systems. a lot to digest just on sanitation.
It's foundational, really.
Okay, let's switch gears now to another massive piece of the puzzle. Energy efficiency. This isn't just about, you know, being green anymore, is it? It really hits the bottom line.
Oh, absolutely. It's huge. Energy efficiency is critical in modern food service, both for the planet and, frankly, for profitability. Kitchens use a lot of energy.
And this is where that consultant role comes back in strongly.
Definitely. A good food service consultant is key here. They are the ones recommending energy-efficient equipment options early on. They worked closely with the MEP teams, that's mechanical, electrical, and plumbing,
right,
to make sure everything integrates properly. They provide the crucial load schedule so the engineers know what energy demands to expect. And doing this right up front helps avoid really expensive change orders down the road.
So the consultant is kind of the energy quarterback.
That's a good way to put it, yeah. They're making sure energy is considered from day one.
And what about the architects designing the building itself? What do they need to understand about kitchen energy loads?
Architects really need a solid grasp of the energy demands, especially in those high-use zones. We keep mentioning the cooking line, the dish room, the refrigeration areas. These are energy hotspots.
Right.
Understanding that is vital for designing the HVAC systems correctly. Heating, ventilation, air conditioning, plus the main ventilation and electrical systems to support it all. And increasingly, specifying energy-efficient equipment directly helps projects achieve sustainability certifications like LEED or WELL.
It all ties together again. Sustainability, cost, function.
Exactly.
Okay, let's get specific. Give us some examples. What kind of equipment offers really good ROI, you know, bang for your buck, when you invest in energy efficiency?
Yeah, there are some clear winners. High-efficiency fryers, for example. They can often slash energy costs by around 50% annually compared to older models. That's huge.
50%, wow.
Energy-efficient dishwashers, depending on the model and usage, can save anywhere from, say, $300 to well over $1,300 a year in water and energy.
Okay, significant.
And ventilation systems. If you use demand-controlled ventilation, which adjusts fan speed based on need, you could easily see savings of $1,000 or more per year compared to a system that just runs full blast all the time.
Those are really compelling numbers. Let's zoom in on dishwashers again. What specific tech makes them more efficient these days?
Modern dishwashers have gotten really smart. Many use dramatically less water, sometimes down to as little as 0.35 to 0.5 gallons per rack. Think about that compared to older machines using several gallons.
Huge difference. Saves water, sewer costs, heating.
And chemical costs, yeah.
Wow.
Then there's drain water energy recovery. This is clever. It uses the heat from the hot drain water going out to preheat the cold clean water coming in for the next rinse. This can reduce the energy needed by the booster heater by maybe 15 to 30%.
Wow, recycling heat.
Exactly. And some also have steam recirculation technology. They reuse heat from the steam generated during the wash cycle, which can actually lower the overall heat load in the dish room, meaning less work for the kitchen's main HVAC system.
Mm.
And like we said, these features tick boxes for things like LED certification.
It's like they're squeezing efficiency out of every drop of water and puff of steam. What about fryers? You mentioned that huge 50% potential saving. How do they do that?
High-efficiency fryers often have advanced burner designs, infrared or improved tube designs that transfer heat to the oil much more efficiently. They heat up faster and, crucially, recover temperature more quickly after you drop in cold food. Less waiting, less energy wasted.
Okay, faster recovery. What else?
Many now have built-in oil filtration systems. This is a big one. Filtering the oil regularly, often automatically, extends its life significantly. That reduces how much new oil you have to buy, which is a major cost, and also reduces oil waste.
So it's not just energy, it's oil savings too.
Big time. And precise temperature controls are key. They prevent the oil from overheating, which wastes energy and also degrades the oil faster, and frankly, makes for better, more consistent food quality. Some of these high-efficiency gas fryers really can save over $3,000 a year just in gas costs compared to standard models.
That's serious money. Okay, griddles, another staple. Are there energy-smart choices there, too?
Absolutely. Energy-efficient griddles often use special conductive alloys in the plate material that spread the heat more evenly. Less hot spots, less wasted energy trying to compensate.
Right.
They might have embedded thermostats right in the griddle plate for more accurate real-time temperature control, preventing overshoot and saving energy. Rapid recovery surfaces are also important. They get back up to temp quickly after food is placed on them, minimizing the energy used during idle times or between batches.
Makes sense.
And a really simple but important thing is right-sizing the griddle. Don't get a massive 6-foot griddle if your menu only requires 3 feet. You're just heating extra metal for no reason. Match it to your actual menu needs.
Right sizing.
Yeah.
Seems obvious, but probably often overlooked.
Very often.
What about holding food? Mm-hmm. Keeping it warm. Holding cabinets, are there energy considerations there?
Yes, definitely. With holding cabinets, the biggest factor is insulation. An insulated unit will hold temperature much more efficiently and use far less energy than an uninsulated one. It seems basic, but it makes a huge difference.
Okay, insulation first. Anything else?
Also, consider the type of heat needed. Dry heat generally uses less energy, but it can dry out certain foods. Humid heat uses more energy to generate the moisture, but is better for keeping things like bread or proteins moist. So the best choice really depends on your specific menu items. You need to balance energy use with food quality.
Got it. Match the heat type to the food. Okay, we can't forget the cold side. Reach in refrigerators and freezers. What energy-saving features should people look for?
Reach-in refrigeration has seen a lot of improvement. A big one is the type of refrigerant used. Look for units using R290 refrigerant. It's a natural refrigerant, propane basically, with a very low global warming potential compared to older synthetic refrigerants. Much more environmentally friendly.
R290. Okay. What else inside the box?
ECM motors. That stands for electronically commutated motors. They're used for the condenser and evaporator fans, and they can be up to 70% more energy efficient than the old standard shaded pole motors.
70%. Wow.
Yeah, big difference. Also, look for expansion valves instead of simpler capillary tubes. They provide more precise dynamic control over the refrigerant flow, optimizing efficiency under different conditions. LED lighting is pretty standard now, uses way less energy than fluorescent, and produces less heat inside the box, which reduces the cooling load.
Less heat inside the fridge helps the fridge work less. Makes sense.
Exactly. And one more thing, often overlooked, design for maintenance access. Making it easy to clean the condenser coils is crucial. Dirty coils make the system work much harder. Good access can improve efficiency by like up to 15%.
So it's not just the tech, but making it easy to maintain the tech.
Absolutely key for long-term efficiency.
Okay, what about the big guys, the walk-in coolers and freezers? Any advanced energy features there beyond the insulation we talked about?
Yes. For walk-in coolers and freezers, besides using thicker panels for higher R values, look for smarter defrost systems. Instead of just defrosting on a timer, whether it needs it or not, on-demand or reverse cycle defrost systems only defrost when necessary, saving significant energy.
Smart defrost.
Okay. Air curtains can be helpful too. Installed over the doorway, they create a barrier of air when the door is open, helping to keep the cold air in and warm, moist air out. Maintains temperature better, reduces system runtime, and the type of compressor matters. Scroll compressors are generally more energy efficient and also tend to be quieter than older reciprocal compressors.
Scroll compressors, got it. Okay, last stop on our energy tour. Exhaust hoods. These things look like they just suck air out, but I hear they can be huge energy users, right? Both the fan energy and the conditioned air they remove.
You are absolutely right. Exhaust hoods can be major energy drains if not designed and operated properly. Ironically, one key step starts before the hood. Using energy-efficient cooking equipment underneath it. Less heat and effluent from the appliances means you might actually need a smaller, less powerful exhaust system to begin with.
Ah, start by reducing the problem at the source. Smart. Wow. Exactly. Then, the hood design itself. Capped wall hoods, meaning hoods against a wall with end panels, are generally more efficient at capturing fumes than island hoods out in the open, simply because the walls help contain the smoke and heat.
Makes sense. Walls help funnel it.
Then there's technology like Capture Jet. This uses small, focused streams of air at the front edge of the hood to push the cooking fumes back towards the filters. This improves capture efficiency so much that you can often reduce the total amount of air being exhausted by up to 50%.
50% less air exhausted. That's huge for saving conditioned air.
Massive impact on HVAC energy costs. Even simpler things like adding side panels to a wall hood can significantly boost its capture performance.
Okay, and controlling the fan speed.
Crucial. Variable frequency drives, VFDs, allow the exhaust fan motor speed to be adjusted so you don't have to run it at 100% all the time. Even better is demand control ventilation, DCV. This uses sensors, either temperature or optical sensors, that literally see smoke and steam. To automatically adjust the fan speed based on the actual amount of cooking happening in real time.
Yeah.
If only one burner is on, the fan ramps down. If the whole line is busy, it ramps up.
So it's like a smart thermostat for your kitchen exhaust.
Precisely. Maximum efficiency, only using the energy needed at that exact moment.
It really is amazing how much thought and tech goes into what most people probably just see as stainless steel boxes and fans. Okay, let's shift focus a bit now. We've covered sanitation and energy. What about how the whole food service landscape itself is evolving? What are some key institutional trends you're seeing in design?
Yeah, the way spaces are used is definitely changing. Take coffee cafes, for example. They're really moving beyond just being a quick transactional stop for caffeine.
Also,
they're morphing into more of an extended stay environment. Think much more comfortable seating, readily available charging stations for devices, higher quality materials and finishes that help tell the brand story. It's about creating a destination.
More like a lounge or a co-working space sometimes.
Exactly, that kind of vibe. And alongside that, there's usually a strong emphasis on efficient grab-and-go options, too, for the people who are still in a hurry. So catering to both needs.
Interesting. A hybrid space. Boy. What about in more traditional restaurants or institutional settings? Any big visual or functional trends?
A really significant trend is the continued rise of the expo kitchen or exposition kitchen, open kitchens.
Ah, where you can see the chefs working.
Right. It offers this great visual appeal, the theater of cooking, even the smells become part of the dining experience. It can really enhance the customer's perception of freshness and quality.
Yeah, I enjoy that.
Strategically, they can also be used to sort of divide large dining spaces or help manage the flow of customers. But there's a catch.
What's that?
The equipment in an expo kitchen isn't hidden anymore. It needs to be not only highly functional and meet all the codes, but it also needs to be aesthetically pleasing, clean, well-maintained. It's part of the decor, essentially.
Right. It has to perform and look good. Kitchen as theater, like you said. And what about the actual serving areas? When we pick up our food or go through a line, what's changing there?
Modern serving areas need incredible flexibility. We're seeing a demand for multiple types of surfaces and stations all in one place. You might have traditional staffed counters alongside self-serve hot and cold wells, maybe dedicated kiosks for ordering, and definitely prominent grab-and-go sections.
Options, options, options.
Lots of options. Digital menu boards are becoming almost standard now. They're so much more flexible than static signs. Easy to update for specials, day parts, nutritional info.
Yeah, much more dynamic.
We're seeing various sneeze guard designs, some more minimal, some more encompassing, depending on the setup and local codes. And certainly the COVID-19 pandemic accelerated trends towards more flexible layouts, maybe using movable partitions or designing stations that can be easily adapted for different service styles or social distancing if needed.
That makes sense. Building in adaptability.
And a really interesting development driven by online ordering and delivery is the emergence of heated and cooled locker systems. Customers order online, get a code, and pick up their food hot or cold from a secure locker without interacting with staff.
Contactless pickup, taken to the next level.
Yeah.
Definitely a sign of the times.
For sure.
Okay, now let's get into the really cutting edge stuff. The new technology is actually inside the kitchen, changing how food is cooked. What innovations are making waves?
The kitchen tech landscape is moving fast. One really interesting piece of equipment is the Vector oven.
Vector oven.
Yeah. These ovens can have multiple independent cooking chambers, often up to 4 stacked vertically. Each chamber has independent temperature, fan speed, and even cook time control.
So you can cook totally different things at once.
Exactly. Fish in one, cookies in another, roasted vegetables in a third, all at the same time with absolutely no flavor transfer between them.
Wow. And the benefit?
Huge flexibility and speed. Plus, a lot of these Vector ovens are ventless. They have built-in catalytic converters to handle grease and odors, so they often don't need to be under a traditional exhaust hood. That's a massive space saver and simplifies installation, especially in tight spots. 4 ovens in one footprint, often without a hood. Game-changing.
Yeah, that sounds incredibly useful, especially for smaller places.
Yeah.
What else is speeding things up?
We're seeing more and more high-speed ovens. These combine multiple cooking technologies, typically convection, microwave, and sometimes impingement, which is like high-velocity hot air.
Okay.
All in one compact unit. The goal is super fast cooking or reheating, often in under 2 minutes, sometimes even under 1 minute for certain items.
Under 2 minutes from raw or just reheating?
Can be both, depending on the item and the oven. Great for things like toasted sandwiches, pizzas, reheating proteins quickly. And like the Vector ovens, many high-speed ovens are also ventless and have a really small footprint. Ideal for coffee shops, bars, kiosks, anywhere needing quick food without a full kitchen setup.
That kind of speed could really revolutionize service, couldn't it?
Absolutely changes the game for certain types of operations.
Okay, speed is one thing. What about equipment that's just more versatile? doing multiple jobs.
Yes, that's another big trend, multifunction equipment. Think about advanced electric skillets, sometimes called brat pans, or known by brand names like iVario.
Right.
These are designed to potentially replace a whole bunch of traditional gear. Tilt skillets, stock pots or kettles, fryers, pressure cookers, even large stovetop ranges for some tasks. They can boil, braise, fry, pressure cook, all in one unit with incredibly precise temperature control.
So consolidation, fewer pieces of equipment.
Exactly. Save space, can lower initial investment, simplifies cleaning, and often helps lower the overall utility load in the kitchen because you're not running as many separate appliances.
Makes a lot of sense. Anything else in that multifunction category?
Combi ovens are probably the most established example. They combine steam cooking, convection, dry heat cooking, and combination modes using both steam and heat.
All right, combis have been around a while, but seem to keep getting smarter.
They really have. Modern combis offer amazing consistency through programmable cooking steps. You can get the exact same result every single time. Many also now come in ventless models, again using catalytic inverters, making them easier to place. And like the skillet, they save space by doing the job of a steamer, a convection oven, and sometimes even help with proofing or re-thermalizing. Really versatile workhorses.
Fewer pieces doing more work. Seems like a key theme.
It really is. Efficiency in every sense. Space, labor, energy.
Speaking of labor, what about all the buzz around robots in the kitchen? Is that just hype or is it actually happening?
It's definitely starting to happen. Robotic technology is finding its niche in commercial kitchens. We're seeing robotic arms making salads, cooking burgers, operating fry stations, even assembling bowls or plating dishes.
Really? Wow. What's driving that?
The primary drivers are, unsurprisingly, addressing labor shortages and costs, and also the potential for increased consistency. Robots don't call in sick, and they perform the task exactly the same way every time. Mm-hmm. Many of these robotic systems are being designed to be quite compact, fitting into existing kitchen lines, and there's a lot of work going into integrating them with other kitchen systems, like the point of sale for orders or inventory management system.
So they talk to the other equipment.
That's the goal, yeah. A more connected, automated kitchen. It feels like we're really on the cusp of seeing this become much more common, especially for repetitive tasks.
A truly automated kitchen. Fascinating. Maybe slightly unnerving, too.
Huh. Yeah. It brings up lots of questions, but the tech is definitely moving in that direction.
It certainly feels like we're entering a new era. Mm. Now, through this entire complex landscape, you know, the deep sanitation rules, the critical energy savings, the evolving trends, the cutting-edge tech, there's usually someone helping navigate all this, right? You mentioned them earlier, the food service consultant.
Exactly. The food service consultant is often the unsung hero in making sure a kitchen project actually works functionally and financially.
What's their role, fundamentally?
They typically get involved very early in the process, working closely with the client, the owner, operator, and the whole design team, the architects, the engineers.
Okay.
A huge part of their job is talking extensively with the actual operators, the chefs, the managers, to really understand their menu, their service style, their workflow needs. Then they translate that into a physical kitchen design.
So tailoring the design to the specific operation.
Precisely. They also play a critical role in reviewing budgets, making sure the equipment specified is realistic for the project's finances, and crucially, they're responsible for integrating all those sanitation requirements, the NSF standards we talked about, right from the very beginning of the design, not as an afterthought.
So they're weaving all these threads together from day one.
That's their core function, from the initial concept down to the final details.
What are some of the concrete things, the deliverables that a consultant provides during a project? What do they actually produce?
Oh, a whole range of essential documents. Detailed floor plans, obviously, showing the layout. Equipment schedules, listing every single piece of equipment, often down to the model number and accessories. These plans focus on optimizing the flow for efficiency and safety.
Okay, the blueprints for the kitchen.
Pretty much. Then they create the utility rough-in drawings. These are vital for the MEP engineers. They show exactly where electrical outlets, gas lines, water connections, drains, and ventilation points need to be located for each piece of equipment.
Super important for coordination.
Absolutely critical to avoid clashes and errors. They also compile the equipment specification book, or spec book. This is like the Bible for the project's equipment. It has cut sheets, technical data, specific options for every single item being purchased.
Everything in one place.
Yep. They usually prepare the bid documents that are used to get competitive pricing from equipment dealers or contractors. They help answer code questions that inevitably come up from health departments or building inspectors. And finally, they typically conduct the final punch lists before the kitchen opens, walking through to make sure everything is installed correctly, working properly, and matches the specifications.
Wow, that's a comprehensive list. Mm-hmm. Sounds like they really are the glue holding the kitchen-specific parts of the project together.
That's a very good description. They bridge the gap between the operator's vision, the architect's building design, the engineer's systems, and the actual equipment that makes it all function.
So summing it up, what are the main advantages, the value proposition, of bringing a food service consultant onto a project team?
I'd say there are three main things. First, they bring a client-focused approach. Their loyalty is to the client and ensuring the kitchen meets the operator's specific needs and budget, not just selling equipment.
Okay, unbiased advice.
Second, they have deep expertise in regulations. They understand the nuances of health codes, NSF standards, ADA requirements, energy codes, etc., which can be a minefield to navigate otherwise.
Yeah, keeping things legal and safe.
And third, they provide that essential coordination piece we talked about. They speak the language of architects, engineers, contractors, and chefs, helping to streamline communication, solve problems proactively, and ultimately reduce costly mistakes and delays during construction. It's really about leveraging specialized expertise to manage complexity.
Having that expert guide through a very complex process seems invaluable.
It really can be, especially on larger or more complicated projects.
Well, it's crystal clear that designing a commercial food service base is far more intricate and fascinating than it might look from the outside. We've covered a huge amount of ground today.
We certainly have.
From those fundamental NSF sanitation standards, all the way through energy efficiency, the latest trends, cutting-edge technologies like robots and vector ovens, and of course, the vital role of the consultant tying it all together.
Absolutely. And I think the big takeaway is how interconnected all these elements are. You know, sanitation impacts design, design impacts energy use, trends influence technology adoption, technology affects workflow. It's all linked.
Yeah, it's a whole system.
It really is. And understanding these pieces offers really valuable insights, whether you're actually working in the industry, planning a project, or even if you're just someone curious about the unseen world that prepares and serves the food we eat every day.
It definitely highlights the surprising amount of thought, innovation, and complexity behind the scenes.
There's a lot more to it than meets the eye.
For sure. So for you, our listener, maybe here's a final thought to chew on. Consider how those often invisible infrastructure choices, the design decisions, the equipment selected in the places where you eat, mm-hmm. how profoundly do they actually impact your health, your safety, maybe even the taste of your food and your overall dining experience? Maybe next time you're grabbing coffee or sitting down for a meal, you'll notice a few more of these details, the flow, the equipment, maybe even the corners, with a perhaps newfound appreciation for everything that goes into creating those spaces.
A little peek behind the curtain.
Exactly. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us today.